This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, very disturbing trends across much of the country recently. The number of heroin overdoses has risen dramatically in recent weeks. The city of Cincinnati, Ohio, alone saw 174 overdoses in less than a week. Officials in many communities from the Midwest to Northeast have seen a huge upsurge of overdoses. They're calling it a public health emergency.
Well, that's right, Mark, and it is such a disturbing trend from West Virginia to Ohio, across New Jersey, throughout the Northeast, and certainly including our home state of Connecticut. It appears that a strand of heroin cut with a synthetic narcotic, fentanyl, which is 10,000 times more powerful than morphine, underlies the spike in the increasing rate of overdose that we're seeing.
The crisis is taxing overworked emergency responders, flooding emergency rooms, and putting a real strain on resources. Hospital systems are being depleted of their supplies of naloxone, better known as Narcan, which can save lives and overdose victims if it's administered in time. But it's in short supply in many of these hardest hit communities.
Well, Mark, the Drug Enforcement Agency has been warning for some time that we would be seeing far more of these incidents as fentanyl continues to work its way into the nation's illegal drug supply. This is just another terrible chapter in the opioid crisis, Mark, and I think we have to brace ourselves for more of these episodes.
There's another prevalent cause of death that people don't often think about, Margaret, and we're going to hear today from Dr. Martin McCary, Johns Hopkins surgeon and leading patient safety researcher, whose recent study captured quite a bit of attention. His research has determined that medical errors are the third leading cause of death behind heart disease and cancer.
Well, although it's hard to believe, it's been 17 years since the Institute of Medicine's seminal report, To Err Is Human, which cast the first spotlight on this issue of patient safety, Mark. It seems to have gotten worse, and we look forward to hearing from Dr. McCary on his important patient safety research.
Laurie Robinson also stops by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Martin McCary in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Coming soon to a pharmacy near you, EpiPen, the generic version. The embattled pharmaceutical company Mylan, embroiled in a consumer backlash over dramatically hiked prices for its life-saving EpiPen, has responded to the criticism, announcing plans to create a generic version, which will sell for about $300 versus the roughly $600 for the name brand version. Mylan's CEO's initial response to the consumer outcry was to offer discount coupons for consumers who couldn't afford the high price tag of the antidote to life-threatening allergic reactions. But the company left the high price of the EpiPen in place, which means insurers and ultimately consumers would still bear the high cost. The generic version should be available within a few months. But many school districts around the country, grappling with a growing number of school-age children facing severe allergies, are still worried they won't be able to keep enough EpiPens in stock. Speaking of school, it's a time when kids of all ages test their grit on the gridiron, the soccer field, lacrosse, and more, and concussions become a frequent occurrence. It turns out taking young athletes out of play immediately upon experiencing a head injury lets the brain heal faster, getting those kids ready for play much sooner. A study done at the University of Arkansas found kids who were removed immediately after a concussion took 22 days to recover from their head injury. Kids who were hit but stayed in the game for the duration took 44 days or more to recover from concussion symptoms. Zika making the rounds. Cases of the mosquito-borne disease have turned up halfway around the world in Singapore, with a little under 100 cases reported so far. Some countries are issuing travel warnings. And pregnant women have more to worry about regarding their unborn fetuses and Zika exposure. In addition to microcephaly and several other neurological disorders, about 6% of babies exposed in utero were born with significant hearing loss as well. The FDA is now recommending that all donated blood in the U.S. be tested for the presence of Zika. And every dog must have its day, and they also apparently know what you say. Brain researchers have confirmed what millions of dog owners already know. They understand not just the words you use, but respond to your tone as well. Researchers in Hungary mapped brain responses in dogs receiving things like praise, and the reward center of the brain instantly lit up. Researchers were surprised to find similarities between dogs and humans. The left hemisphere, which is central to language and cognitive meaning, lit up every time a dog heard his master say certain things. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital and professor of health policy at Bloomberg School of Health. He's the youngest physician to be given an endowed chair at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. McCary is an international expert on patient safety, is an advocate for transparency in medicine, having co-created the Surgical Checklist, an initiative several years ago. He served in a leadership role at the World Health Organization. Dr. McCary is a New York Times best-selling author of Unaccountable, which outlines flaws in the American healthcare system and ways to improve it. He earned his undergraduate degree at Bucknell, his master's of public health from Harvard, his medical degree from Thomas Jefferson University, and he did his residency at Georgetown. Dr. McCary, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great, thank you.
You know, the short story of your work is that too many patients suffer harm in the U.S. health system, but until the Institute of Medicine released its seminal report to Error is Human back in 1999, the issue of medical errors and their link to premature deaths had not been fully understood. And you recently released the results of a longitudinal study that took a look at the problem of deaths due to medical errors, and you concluded that it's now the third leading cause of death in this country. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners about your study and how the data led you to this distressing conclusion.
Well, we had an incident where a patient died directly from a medical error. It was a young patient after surgery. And in filling out the death certificate, where it asks you what was the immediate cause of death, we thought, what do we put here? And it turns out that that field in the death certificate populates our country's national health statistics. Well, of course, when someone dies of any type of medical care gone wrong, be it an overdose, be it a preventable surgical complication, be it an unnecessary treatment that ended up, the patient, if they die, will eventually code and go through cardiac arrest, and someone will do CPR, and then you're forced to fill out the death certificate. What do you put? It turns out that the way our country extracts national health statistics and creates that list every year is based on the billing code system. Well, there's no billing code for overdose or preventable complications. So we've basically not been measuring the problem of medical care gone wrong in the United States. And it all sort of hit us when we had this young girl who died of preventable death. You know, it's hard to be involved in a case where someone dies not from the disease or injury that brings them to care, but rather from the care itself. We don't want to blame people. Look, medicine is a wonderful profession. We don't want to create fear. And unfortunately, some of the media likes to sensationalize the subject of patient safety. But the reality is that the IOM study from 1999 has no original research. They cite two studies, one from 1984 and one from 1992. They're not great studies. Mm-hmm. And we've been citing this number as if it hasn't changed over the last quarter century or more. Well, all we did is took the most recent studies cited when it comes to a description of how many people die from medical care gone wrong among Medicare beneficiaries in the OIG report, the study in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Health Affairs study. We took the best available science. And guess what? It turns out that the range that we report, and by the way, we're not the first to do it, is higher than the third leading cause of death currently listed on the CDC's list. So if we just update the science, it turns out that we've got a problem, and that problem deserves the funding at a federal level and the public awareness that is proportionate to its burden in public health.
Well, Dr. McCary, you pointed out that one of the significant parts of the problem in trying to quantify and address it is understanding exactly what the problem is, and that's usually done through the coding system. So for our listeners, the International Classification of Diseases, or the ICD, was designed in the mid-20th century to help us understand diagnoses as well as causes of death, but we weren't thinking medical errors as part of the equation at that time. And last year, we transitioned the nation's health system to a new version of the ICD codes, which was designed to improve the collection of detailed health data. And what would you want to see within the coding system that would help healthcare institutions be more precise and give us a clearer understanding of what these medical errors are?
There is tremendous wisdom among clinicians. And if you actually talk to doctors, they'll tell you a lot of people who are making decisions are not asking them for their opinion. People are concerned about this loss of autonomy, and in no other area is it a bigger problem than patient safety. If we look at these ideas on how to deliver care with more reliability, it turns out that ARC, even the NIH, get tons of proposals every year from docs and doctor groups on how to design better, safer, more efficient, more high-value healthcare, but they say we don't have the funding. One of the reasons why we've underappreciated and underfunded the problem of quality and safety in American healthcare is that it's not on the CDC's list of national health statistics. So we've got to realize that people don't just die from heart disease and bacteria. They die from medical care gone wrong, and there's no billing code for medical care gone wrong. We've got to get away from the billing code system that was designed to maximize bills and recognize that when someone dies of an unnecessary operation having a preventable complication or an overdose or a fragmented insurance network that doesn't allow someone to get the appropriate care, that problem is low-hanging fruit when it comes to improving healthcare and get away from this idea that we only use bills. When someone dies from one of those problems, at some point their heart stops and then it goes down as a heart disease. We know those numbers are overinflated with cases that are downstream cardiac arrest from some other part of the medical care going wrong, leading to sepsis or something else. Look, I'm a cancer surgeon, and as a cancer surgeon, we go through this incredible length to document our cancer statistics in the United States every year. I document its type and the subtype and the stage and the age of the patient, and it goes into our national database at the NCI. And we put out a report every year titled United States Cancer Statistics. We need to treat patient safety the same way, with the same scientific rigor that we use to measure other things in healthcare.
Dr. McCary, as a patient safety activist, you're also an advocate for more transparency in healthcare. In your 2013 book, Unaccountable, you explored how the inherent flaws in the American health systems are exacerbated by a systematic lack of transparency. You say we need a transparency revolution. Now, I'm wondering if you could give our listeners some examples of where transparency has been achieved and how it's transformed outcomes, and how we might better advance as patient advocates transparency in healthcare.
Well, you know, what we've seen is a loss of control over healthcare by the doctors who are actually delivering it. Our services as doctors are being bought and sold on a grid like electricity is. And we're the engines, we're creating the services, we're delivering the services, but there's this massive industry behind us buying and selling and trading our services. We don't even have any idea how our services are sold at a discounted rate to insurance through an employer-based insurance. So this massive industry has grown so large that doctors now feel like they're working in this corporate medicine environment where they're getting crushed. And they're in this squeeze right now, and what you have is record levels of burnout, and you have this system that is really not accountable to anybody, but instead squeezes the doctor. And what I've argued for is that we've got great ideas in healthcare to live with the doctor, but what we need to do is instead of create a quality metric from on high, we need to ask the doctor what they think is a good quality metric, and then apply that. And we started to do that with our new project, Improving Wisely, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Professional associations of doctors create a quality metric. We apply it to big data, look at the distribution of performance, and just share that data back with the doctors and say, hey, here's how you're doing. Here's how the rest of the country's doing. There's no penalty. We believe in civility. It's for your own improvement. And what we're finding is that surgeons that have operated for 30 and 40 years without a single person weighing in on coaching them or new techniques are now saying, hey, how can I do this differently? And it's an exciting time right now. I think if you give doctors the power in healthcare, they have a tremendous capacity to drive improvement.
I want our listeners to know about one of your really remarkable contributions, and a contribution that was so elegant in its simplicity, I think, something that lay people can relate to, and that was the idea of a checklist, the surgical checklist, though not our usual task checklist, fashioned after a routine checklist that pilots go through before they're allowed to fly. And your initiative, I think many people read about it in Dr. Atul Gawande's work, The Checklist Manifesto. I think you both helped the World Health Organization launch a surgical checklist protocol around the globe. Tell us about the increased use of checklists in healthcare, and maybe for our listeners, just what a difference that's made in the surgical arena.
Well, it's interesting. My research partner, Peter Pronovost, had just created a checklist in the ICU for the placement of a central line. And he said, hey, Marty, you're a surgeon. Why don't you come up with one for the operating room? We published a couple articles on it. And then the WHO said, hey, we're looking for projects to base our safe surgery campaign on in patient safety. Well, we took this checklist that's sort of a simple common sense thing in healthcare that surgeons really liked. And Atul Gawande, who's head of the committee, we presented the surgery checklist I published on. And initially, he didn't love the idea, but then warmed up to it, and of course, popularized the whole checklist in the book Checklist Manifesto. Now our challenge is to tell people, mostly hospital administrators, this is not the cure-all. You can't just download a checklist and think you've improved patient safety. The checklist and any other patient safety tool relies on a great workplace culture of safety. And that's really what we've spent a lot of our time talking about. How do you create a workplace of teamwork and speaking up and eliminating the intimidation that lives in our operating rooms? You know, I'm about to go into surgery here at Johns Hopkins. We've got to work to make sure our nurses feel comfortable speaking up. That's an important safety net in the system. So the surgery checklist was designed, really it was to create a discussion so we can address each other with civility, call each other by name, and work as a well-lubricated team to get the job done. And what we found is that there are fewer delays and actually fewer complications when the checklist has been implemented.
We're speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. McCary is an international expert on patient safety, is an advocate for transparency in medicine. Dr. McCary, you've noted that there's an unhealthy relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and frontline clinicians. And a recent study revealed that just a simple lunch between a pharmaceutical rep and a clinician leads to higher prescription rates of certain drugs. And you say the tide is starting to turn, but I think I just saw a published results of the dollar amounts that some of noted hospital in our part of the world had received from pharmaceutical companies. And it was supposed to have put public pressure on folks, but it looked like the dollars were increasing. So explain how we might start preventing this relationship from continuing.
Pharma can do a good job educating doctors on some of the scientific developments that we just cannot keep up with routinely. Same for device companies. But what we're all appalled at is when we're treated like you go into a used car dealership and they're trying to pawn off a car on you to meet their 30-day sales numbers. And by the same token, we don't like being treated by our own hospitals or payers to say you've got to see 5 patients in an hour or 25 operations in a month.
Isn't it true, though, that some of the best schools like Harvard Medical School have stopped this practice and, in fact, don't need a pharma, but rather need pharmacists who are trained, who are independent-minded? How is it possible that having a lunch with somebody isn't going to lead to something else?
Yeah, it is on the way out. You know, GlaxoSmithKline recently announced, due to a lot of pressure, they're no longer going to pay their sales reps a commission based on sales. And that's the change we want to see industry-wide and worldwide. We don't want to see lip service in the U.S. and then they're paid this high commission sales model overseas, like we've seen with tobacco. Johns Hopkins has banned all of that stuff, the pharma lunches, the gifts, the pharma relationships. So if we can do that, if we can ban drug reps from the hospital, we can still get by. There's other ways to learn about new drug developments, and we don't have to have this cozy relationship that really polluted fields like macular degeneration, where the Lucentis company pays a direct kickback to doctors based on sales of how much they use.
Well, Dr. McCary, I know you've also participated with journalists from ProPublica who compiled the nation's first surgeon scorecard. The thought was consumers have a right to know with choosing a surgeon. And I understand there was some pushback from the medical establishment over this. So tell us about this, why and how the surgeon scorecard was devised, and how is it being used by the consumer?
We, in our research group, believe firmly that doctors should see their data in a civil fashion. We shouldn't be humiliating people. We should be analyzing the data and sharing with doctors where they fall relative to national benchmarks. And we do it in a peer-to-peer fashion. So when the professional society says, hey, here's your data as a courtesy, we're sharing this with you ahead of what's anticipated to be publicly reported metrics by third parties, here's where you fall relative to the country. And I think when the metric is good, doctors want to see their data. They want to see how many average cuts it takes them to remove a standardized lesion for skin cancer. So they want to see their average risk-adjusted complication rate using American College of Surgeons definitions. But the reality is other people have access to this data. And when these other parties like ProPublica say, we're sick of this lack of transparency in healthcare. We're sick of, you know, dangerous doctors going without any checks and balances, even though they represent a small fraction of doctors. We want to make data publicly available. That's what third parties are saying. That's what the public is crying for. That's what ProPublica is responding to in making data publicly available. My feeling is if they're going to do it, I want to be there to try to do my best to help guide the data to make it reliable and accurate. Because quite honestly, I found that ProPublica was listening and had good intentions and everything that they were doing. Now, the public reported surgeon complication rate that they made public was not well received by the surgical community. It's ironic because we've embraced, as a healthcare community, hospital readmission rates. But if you start breaking it down by clinician, a massive backlash that I think was probably related to the way they went about releasing and announcing the data.
You know, Dr. McCary, I was thinking about an interview we did with Dr. Provenost, and he was talking to us about his experience of trying to change the culture within the operating room, and sort of went around the room and said, you know, to everyone outside of the docs, if you saw this error, would you raise your hand? And nobody said, we would never raise our hand. And I'm just wondering if the data that you're talking about shouldn't be shared with the team as well. If a provider is deficient in an area, shouldn't every member of the team be aware of that to help make sure that we prevent these medical errors?
You know, I think that docs want to do better. You know, we work hard, right? To become a transplant surgeon, I mean, that is a huge grunt to get there. To be then humiliated by some metric that's unfit, and even the fear of it, which is based on a history that is real. But when we can engage with doctors, listen to their ideas, and create homegrown metrics that they believe in, then we've really changed things. And I have tremendous success stories in healthcare that I write about in the book Unaccountable, of docs creating great metrics of quality, using those metrics, and improving. It frustrates everybody to see the small fraction of doctors that are outliers. And as a society, as a profession, we've got to ask ourselves, now that we can measure quality, what do we do when we see an extreme outlier? You know, we've got data now on risk-adjusted complications. And of course, most doctors are doing the right thing and all is well and fall within a certain range. But then you've got a couple that are so far out there, there is no way to justify anything except incompetence, lack of judgment. What do we do with those extreme outliers that we can now identify by name? Do we have an ethical duty to do something about these outliers that we can identify by name? I believe we should start by reaching out to that doctor and sharing with them where they stand relative to national benchmarks. If they are extreme dangerous outliers, I think we, in our Improving Wisely project, we turn it over to the association and say, you know, we leave it to you to decide how to go about addressing this issue, because after all, they create the metric of what's considered to be quality care.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, patient safety advocate, surgeon, and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins Hospital and Johns Hopkins University. You can learn more about his work by going to martimd.com. Dr. McCary, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Great to be with you both.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senator John McCain of Arizona, who celebrated his 80th birthday in late August, is running for re-election. His opponent in the primary made his age an issue, implying that McCain may not live long enough to fulfill another six-year term. Actually, the odds are in his favor. McCain's opponent, Kelly Ward, a doctor and former Arizona State Senator, noted that McCain would be 86 years old in 2022, the end of a six-year Senate term. Ward said, quote, "The life expectancy of the American male is not 86, it's less." It's true that the life expectancy is 76.28 years for American males at birth for the year 2013, but life expectancy is actually 88.2 years for an average male who has made it to 80 years old. That's according to the Social Security Administration. Life expectancy at birth is less than it is at age 80 because it factors in mortality rates for all age groups. That includes infants who die at birth, which brings the average down for the population as a whole. But life expectancy calculations for an 80-year-old only consider mortality rates for individuals who've already lived to that age. While the average 80-year-old alive today is predicted to live to age 88.2, some individuals may have shorter or longer life spans, depending on environmental and genetic factors. In fact, a study in mice published in the journal Nature in 2013, found that genetic mutations inherited from one's mother can speed up the process of aging and may influence lifespan. While later studies have supported this finding, the mechanism explaining this correlation has yet to be uncovered. Given this research, it's worth pointing out that McCain's mother is still living and is 104 years old. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between typically teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Unfortunately, a teen's level of depression isn't realized until they take drastic action. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us, and then the counselor on the other side is not working from a phone, and they're on a screen that almost looks kind of like Facebook or Gmail.
Nancy Lublin is founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help, which they receive instantly. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So we don't take them chronologically. If you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red. You get flagged in our system. And the supervisor would determine whether or not this person with the imminent harm.
Since she founded Crisis Text, the word has spread like wildfire. They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas, such as a fight with a boyfriend, to kids contemplating suicide Those in most danger are encouraged to take action through a series of channels. Crisis text line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention, available free of charge and 24/7 to give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.